From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to Episode 7 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Coming up on this edition of NIH Research Radio, Matt Thornton has a story about the importance of recognizing the early signs of stroke. We'll tell you about a research study that's looking for the secret to long, healthy life by talking to people who have lived long, healthy lives. As we observe the 25th anniversary of the first reported cases of AIDS, Calvin Jackson talks with researchers at NIH who were involved in the early days of the fight against the disease. Wally Akinso shares some interesting numbers concerning Americans with diabetes, but first, a word about a new middle school curriculum developed by the NIH. That's coming up in 30 seconds right here on NIH Research Radio. At the NIH, we know there's much to be learned from families, especially where one brother or sister has rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, scleroderma, or myositis, and the other does not. Now, does that sound like your family? Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116. If you're eligible, study-related tests are free. You'll be compensated for your time, and transportation may be reimbursed. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency and part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Middle school teachers across the country will now have access to three new curriculum supplements designed to promote inquiry-based, interdisciplinary learning and therefore stimulate students' interest in science. The National Institutes of Health provides these supplements free of charge to teachers, allowing them to update their lesson plans with all-in-one teaching materials that incorporate topical issues and current scientific research, according to Dr. David Vanier, a health science policy analyst at the Office of Scientific Education at the NIH.
What we're doing is bringing some of the latest research that NIH conducts and funds into the K-12 classroom in a meaningful way. What we try to do is to bring that into the classroom in the form of hands-on lessons specifically targeted either middle school or at high school. The three new ones that are coming out are all targeted at middle school.
The three new modules are Doing Science, the Process of Scientific Inquiry, in which students explore the basics of scientific inquiry, refine their critical thinking skills, and learn to appreciate the purpose of scientific research. Looking Good, From the Inside Out, exploring bone, muscle, and skin, wherein students will learn about the structures of the musculoskeletal and skin systems, the interactions between these body systems, and the factors that influence their functions. And The Science of Mental Illness, in which students will gain insight into the biological basis of mental illness and how scientific evidence and research can help us understand its causes and lead to treatments and, ultimately, cures. NIH produced these modules in partnership with curriculum developers from Biological Sciences Curriculum Study of Colorado Springs, Colorado. For more information, visit the NIH Office of Science Education website at science.education.nih.gov/supplements. Early treatment is vital if there's any hope of avoiding permanent disability after a stroke. Of course, in order to get early treatment, one has to be aware that a stroke is happening. Matt Thornton has this report.
According to the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, stroke is the number three killer and the leading cause of long-term disability in the United States, and more than 700,000 Americans will suffer a stroke each year. An important key to successful treatment of stroke is knowing the symptoms and what to do if you or someone you know seems to be in the early stages of a stroke. Some of the signs and symptoms of a stroke include sudden numbness or weakness of the face, arm, or leg, trouble speaking or understanding speech, and severe headache with no known cause. If you are suffering from any of these symptoms or witness them in someone else, every minute counts. Early treatment is vital, and potential stroke sufferers need to be treated as soon as possible to have any chance of avoiding long-term disability. Of course, a good way to avoid having a stroke is to avoid the conditions that could lead to one. Dr. Richard T. Benson, a neurologist with the NINDS, talks about ways to possibly avoid a stroke.
The number one modifiable risk factor for stroke is high blood pressure. If you have high blood pressure, it's important to take your medication as prescribed and also to follow your blood pressure. A lot of people will take medication but won't follow their blood pressure and it may not be controlled. So it's not enough just to take the medication. You have to still follow up and know the numbers. The normal blood pressure is 120 over 80. If you have diabetes, you should take your medication or your insulin. Watch your diet. If you have high cholesterol, you have to take that medication as prescribed, as well as stopping smoking and to exercise.
For more information about the symptoms of stroke or stroke prevention, log on to www.ninds.nih.gov/stroke or call 1-800-352-9424. From the National Institutes of Health, I'm Matt Thornton in Bethesda, Maryland.
When we come back, Calvin Jackson talks with NIH researchers about the early days of the fight against HIV/AIDS. That's coming up when NIH Research Radio continues in 60 seconds. No doubt about it, you're on your way to the top. You're young, you've got the education, you've got the talent. So what's the harm in a little celebrating? I mean, what could possibly go wrong?
You're under arrest for disorderly conduct. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will
be held. Lift one leg 6 inches off the ground and count to 30. What's the matter? You look a little wobbly.
Come on, baby. It's just a wine cooler.
It'll help you relax.
It's just a couple drinks, right? What could possibly go wrong? Plenty. That's what. The path to success is tough enough for young adults. Why make it even tougher? If alcohol is a problem for you or someone you know, visit www.niaaa.nih.gov for more information. Brought to you by this station and the National Institutes of Health, an agency of the United States Department of Health and Human Services. June 5th marks the 25th anniversary of the first reported cases of what is now known as the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, or AIDS. From a handful of initial reports in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, AIDS has grown into a global pandemic affecting men, women, and children in nearly every country of the world. Researchers at NIH were involved in the early diagnosis and treatment of this disease as they searched for the cause, ultimately identified as the human immunodeficiency virus. Calvin Jackson talks to some of those scientists involved in the early days of AIDS in this first in a series of reports.
On June 5, 1981, the first article about AIDS in the medical literature appeared in Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Dr. Anthony Fauci, currently the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, recalls,
"My initial reaction to the first report in June was that this was some sort of a fluke, some sort of a drug that had been taken by a cluster of gay men that may have suppressed their immune system to allow them to get this opportunistic infection." But then when the second report came out in July in a different part of the country, and then subsequently thereafter reported in injection drug uses, then I was filled with a great deal of an ominous feeling that we were dealing with a brand new disease that was likely an infectious agent. But as you know, at that time, we had absolutely no idea what that infectious agent was.
A senior investigator with the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the time, Dr. Fauci was one of the few researchers devoted solely to human immunobiology. He assembled a small group of scientists to study the emerging disease and quickly converted his lab from one that explored fundamental questions of immunology to one that focused on AIDS.
I made a deliberate decision to dramatically modify the direction of my research towards the end of the summer and the beginning of the fall of 1981 as more and more cases began to trickle in subsequent to the initial cases that were reported in Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. What I did was start to study these patients, bring them into the 11th floor, which is our inpatient ward in the NIH Clinical Center. I had a young fellow at the time in the laboratory, Dr. Cliff Lane, who is now the clinical director of the NIAID, and I asked if he was interested in pursuing this as a fellow and he was very enthusiastic about it. We brought Henry Mazur down from New York City, where he had been one of the first people to describe HIV-infected individuals, so that we could have some strength in the intensive care unit, because we knew that when we brought these people in, they would be very sick. At the time, we were not aware who was HIV-infected, because we didn't know what the agent was, and they didn't come to our attention until they were very sick.
As the first official hospital epidemiologist at the NIH Clinical Center, Dr. David Henderson was charged with protecting the hospital staff from HIV infection even before the virus and its mode of transmission were identified.
The first AIDS patient was actually admitted to the clinical center before anything had been written about the disease in April of 1981. And in sort of rapid fire succession, because that's what the clinical center is all about, we began having these patients coming to the hospital throughout the early 1980s. And in fact, I think even before we understood what caused the disease, up to that time, we'd probably already provided care for in the neighborhood of 500 patients with AIDS. So the NIAID and clinical center scientists and scientists in the NCI were aggressively studying the disease, the complications, and the management of patients who had this new syndrome. AIDS and HIV infection took me out of the laboratory and really made hospital epidemiology a full-time job for a pretty extended period of time, as I would basically arm myself with the newest information I could get my hands on, and then walk around the hospital and work with the staff who were providing care for these patients to make sure that they understood what we understood about the disease so the work could go on.
While some researchers searched for the cause of AIDS, Dr. Cliff Lane, who came to the NIH in 1979, concentrated on understanding the immune system abnormalities in people with AIDS and looked for ways to stop the disease. Working with Dr. Anthony Fauci, Dr. Lane became the first to attempt bone marrow and white blood cell transfers from healthy twins to their identical siblings with AIDS as a therapeutic strategy.
I think the first patient I saw was probably in 1982. This was a patient that Dr. Henry Mazur had seen in the clinic. And Henry had elicited a piece of history from the patient that he had an identical twin brother. So Henry came to see me and asked, was there anything in particular that I thought we might want to do in the laboratory, given this unique situation? And I said, well, maybe there's something we could do in the clinic. Why don't we try to do a bone marrow transplant from the healthy donor into the patient with AIDS? And that became one of the first therapeutic protocols that we did, probably on the campus, for patients with AIDS. And we transferred lymphocytes from the healthy twin to the patient with AIDS. We found in those studies that we could transfer specific immunity to an antigen that we immunized the donor to. So we knew we had transferred some degree of immunity. We saw an increase in the helper T cell count in the recipient, but these were all transient changes.
This is Calvin Jackson, the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
On our next edition of NIH Research Radio, we'll hear more from some of the NIH pioneers about the early days of the fight against HIV/AIDS. Coming up, what better way to learn the secrets of a long, healthy life than by talking to people who have lived long, healthy lives? That's next when NIH Research Radio continues. Every day, researchers are unlocking many of cancer's mysteries. But what's the best way to accurately and effectively communicate this important news to other researchers, doctors, patients, and the public? One trusted source for up-to-date cancer research news and information comes from the National Cancer Institute, the federal government's premier cancer research agency. The NCI Cancer Bulletin is a free weekly online publication that offers a single source for comprehensive coverage of cancer programs and research. In recent weeks, the NCI Cancer Bulletin has reported on higher numbers of cancers in type 2 diabetics, new drugs being effective in women with stage 2 or 3 operable breast cancer, how NCI's budget has been affected by federal belt tightening, and caring for cancer caregivers. You can keep pace with these and other topics by reading the NCI Cancer Bulletin. Visit www.cancer.gov/NCI Cancer Bulletin to sign up for your free electronic subscription today. Have you ever noticed how some families tend to have a large representation of healthy elderly relatives? Is there some kind of secret, some different thing these folks are doing that affords them such long, healthy lifespans? That's what they'd like to find out with the Long Life Family Study, a project supported by the National Institute on Aging.
The study is recruiting families to participate, according to Winnie Rossi, deputy director of the NIA's Geriatrics and Clinical Gerontology Program.
Well, we know that long, healthy life tends to run in some families. And the researchers from the Long Life Family Study want to know what are the secrets that contribute to these long and healthy lives. So we're trying to identify factors that contribute protection against disease and disability that allow some people to live so long and so well.
Ms. Rossi explained how this study differs from many of the other studies undertaken and supported by the National Institutes of Health.
Many studies that take place at NIH look at risk factors for disease and disability. We're looking in this study at ways to better understand factors that protect against disease and disability and promote healthy longevity.
Researchers are seeking a large number of families with several long-lived members, especially families with at least two living members aged 80 or older who reside near Pittsburgh, Boston, or New York, as well as their living children. Participants will be asked to provide a small blood sample to obtain genetic information to help determine the role that genes might play in long, healthy survival, in addition to many other factors. For more info, check out www.nia.nih.gov. Would you be surprised to learn that for every three people with diabetes in America, one isn't even aware of having the disease? Wally Akinso has this report.
A recent study shows that one out of three people suffering from diabetes isn't even aware of having the disease. The study was conducted by researchers at the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Type 2 diabetes accounts for approximately 95% of all diabetes cases, and virtually all undiagnosed diabetes cases are among people with type 2 diabetes. Dr. Catherine Cowie, the lead author, discusses the study.
We wanted to know how many adults age 20 and older in the U.S. have diabetes. We used data from a national survey that was conducted during 1999 to 2002. It is called the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. Participants were interviewed in their homes to find out whether they had ever been diagnosed with diabetes. But what makes this national survey unique is that participants have a blood sample drawn after an overnight fast. The blood test gives us important information such as whether people have diabetes and don't know it. In other words, they've not yet been diagnosed with diabetes. The blood samples also tell us whether people have a form of pre-diabetes called impaired fasting glucose. If you have prediabetes, you have blood glucose levels that are higher than normal, but not yet high enough to be diagnostic of diabetes, and these individuals are at risk of later getting diabetes. We then compared the prevalence of these conditions in 1999 to 2002 with similar national data from 1988 to 1994.
Prediabetes, which usually causes no symptoms, is serious because many people with a condition go on to develop type 2 diabetes in the next 10 years. According to Dr. Cowie, prediabetes increases the risk of a heart attack or stroke even if type 2 diabetes doesn't develop.
We continue to find that these conditions, which are undiagnosed, are occurring in a very large percent of the population. Again, one-third of people with diabetes do not know they have it, and 26% of adults in the whole population are at risk of getting it. We need to do a better job of diagnosing the one in three people who don't know they have diabetes, as well as the people who have IFG. We also need to do a better job of convincing people that they need to adopt healthy behaviors that will prevent these conditions.
Some of the healthy behaviors Dr. Cowie referred to include cutting down on the calories and physical activity. The study was published in the June 2006 issue of Diabetes Care. For more information about diabetes, visit www.ndep.nih.gov. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
And with that, we come to the end of another edition of NIH Research Radio.
I'd like to thank Wally Akinso, Calvin Jackson, and Matt Thornton for their reports, as well as Dr. David Vanier from the Office of Science Education, Dr. Richard Benson at the NINDS, Dr. Catherine Coey at the NIDDK, and Winnie Rossi at the NIA. Please join us on Friday, June 16th, when Episode 8 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on nearly 1,000 radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio and on the HealthStar Radio Network. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The info is right there on the podcast webpage. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfelt. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, proud part of the news media branch at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.